Good evening and welcome to tonight's monthly teleconference. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct several question and answer sessions. If you would like to ask a question, press 1 on your touch-tone keypad. Please try to ask questions that are general in nature and that might appeal to the larger group. Once your question is asked, your line will be remuted. Questions will be taken in order that they are received. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Piper Reynolds, Senior Manager of Programs for the National MS Society, Greater Northwest Chapter. Piper, you may begin.
Great, thank you. And thanks so much to everyone for registering for our December monthly teleconference. We're very pleased to have you all on the line with us this evening. Tonight's teleconference will focus on building a community of support. Coping with MS can be a challenge, but it is manageable with help from others. This evening, you will learn about opportunities to further build your support network, meet others with MS both in person and online, and gain skills for how to ask for help and deal with emotions such as loneliness and feelings of isolation. Our featured speakers include Dr. Moshele Toshima. Dr. Toshima is the clinical rehabilitation psychologist for the MS Center at Swedish Neuroscience Institute. She recently joined the MS Center at Swedish in March 2009. Prior to her current position, Dr. Toshima was a clinical associate professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington Medical Center and an MS specialist at the MS Center at Evergreen Healthcare. Dr. Toshima completed her Bachelor of Arts degree in Behavioral Sciences at California Polytechnic University, Pomona, and her doctoral degree in clinical psychology with a specialization in behavioral medicine from the joint doctoral program at University of California, San Diego, San Diego State University. She also completed a postdoctoral fellowship in chronic pain at the University of Washington. Dr. Toshima focuses on helping patients maximize their potential despite challenges. She understands that coping with medical conditions and physical or cognitive disability can be a major challenge to patients, their families, and the community. Dr. Toshima is dedicated to promoting education and advocacy, training and research, and enhancing the quality of life for patients living with MS. Thank you so much for your time this evening, Dr. Toshima.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be here.
You will also hear from Greg Robinson, staff member at the Greater Northwest Chapter. And Greg is the connections manager for the chapter and will share the programs he works on with you all this evening. And I will speak about our education program opportunities through the chapter that you can get involved with. Following this evening's teleconference, you will receive a program evaluation by email, which we urge you to complete as your feedback and ideas are very important to us. Within that email, you'll receive information about our upcoming teleconferences and other chapter programs and services available to you. Okay, so I thank you again for being on the call this evening and would like to hand it off to Dr. Toshima, and you may begin.
Thank you very much, Piper. Well, welcome everyone to our discussion and information about building a community of support. And what I'm going to focus on is some of the things that get in the way of people seeking social support or building social support, and also ways to ask for help, and also talking about the different types of support that are available. So first of all, a question I'd like to ask all of you is, why is social support so important? And just take a moment to think about that. Why is social support or community support or support of any kind important? Well, it provides a sense of belonging. It provides security. It provides a sense of purpose for some folks. It can provide self-worth, can provide a sense of positive mental health, feeling part of a larger community. And if you take a moment, you may think of other reasons too about why social support is so important. So I'm glad you're all here today to learn more about how to develop your own support systems. Before we get started talking about what some of the barriers are and what some of the issues are in seeking out social support, I wanted to talk about the different types of support because it's really important to know these different types. The first type of support is what we call emotional support, and this is often what we think of when we think of social support. Emotional support involves feeling connected with others, having a sense of belonging, and feeling understood. These are the people you can call when you are feeling down and you just want to talk, or you want someone to hear you out when you're upset, or you just want them to be with you. That's emotional support. Another type of support is tangible support. And tangible support is the practical support that we can get from family, friends, coworkers, neighbors, volunteer organizations, and basically anyone who assists us with doing things. So this includes things like asking a friend or family member to help out with chores, or to provide you with transportation, or to babysit, and so on. It can also be a stranger offering to carry something for you. In the workplace, tangible support may come in the form of assistive technology or a special parking spot. So that's kind of what tangible support is. It's very different from emotional support. A third kind of support to consider is what we call informational support. And informational support involves receiving information and gaining knowledge about something important to you. For example, with MS, being well informed about the latest research findings, advocacy groups, financial counseling, and therapies really can provide not only a sense of hope and control, but also solutions to everyday problems associated with MS. Conversely, a lack of information can lead you to imagining the worst and may contribute to unnecessary fear, a sense of helplessness, and feeling overwhelmed. So the National MS Society is an example of a good source of informational support. Your healthcare providers is also another source of good informational support. And the last type of support to think about or to consider is what I call companionship support. And companion support is when you're looking for someone to go to the movies with or to an art show. You may not want to talk about anything emotional or difficult. You may not need anything in particular. You just want a companion to do an activity with. And sometimes people who provide us with this type of support are not necessarily people that we would consider our closest or our dearest friends. They may also not be somebody who we would ask to do much in the way of favors. But this type of support shouldn't be underestimated either. So we've got the four types of support. There's emotional support, tangible support, informational support, and companionship support. So the question that I'd like to ask people is, who provides what type of support? It's really important to understand that different people are better at providing different types of support. Sometimes this is really obvious. For example, you probably wouldn't ask your neighbor for a prescription, and you probably hopefully wouldn't ask your doctor for a ride to the market. But a lot of times we ask someone who may be really good at listening to our problems to help us organize our files or to mow our lawn for us, and they don't come through. Or sometimes we try confiding something really emotional and difficult to someone who isn't a good listener. So to reach out successfully for support, it's really important to focus on what your needs are and determine who can best meet those needs. So I have a couple of examples just for you to think about to see if you get the concept of the different types of support and who provides what. So here's the situation. Let's say that a friend calls to find out if you need to talk, and you are feeling overwhelmed by all the things you need to get done, such as the household chores, the errands, phone calls, things like that. So what type of support is your friend offering? Your friend is offering emotional support. And what type of support do you feel like you need in the moment? You're needing tangible support. So in that instance, oftentimes the person who's offering support and you are going to be frustrated because you're not going to have, you're not going to be on the same page in terms of what someone's offering and what you're needing in the moment. Here's another example. Let's say you recently had a series of setbacks and you are feeling worried. Your best friend comes over and begins to talk to you about the benefits of good diet and exercise and all of those things. So what type of support is your friend offering? Your friend is offering informational support. And what type of support do you need in the moment? You're needing emotional support. So first things first, learning what type of support people are able and willing to give is important to getting your social support needs met. It's also important to remember that a person's ability to provide support can vary over time depending on his or her own life circumstances. So think about what type of support you want and who is best suited to provide you with that type of support. The other thing to think about is to flip the tables and to ask yourself, What kind of support do you best provide? And sometimes it's frustrating if people ask you to help them with something when you feel incapable or it's not something you're well suited to do. So think about it from both perspectives. What are people offering you and what are they good at providing? And also, what are you good at providing in terms of support in return? Another question to consider is, do you have enough support? Ideally, you would want a number of people to provide each type of those supports for you. If you have multiple people you can rely on for each type of support, it's more likely that you'll get the support you need at any given time. And Greg will be discussing how to meet new people later in the program. But if you find that you're short on social support, then it's really important to build those support systems. I would encourage you to take a piece of paper sometime later today or tomorrow and divide it into four sections and write the different types of social support in each section. Then ask yourself, who do I have in my life that provides me with this type of support? Then take a moment and rate how satisfied you are with the support you have in each of those areas. This will help you identify if you need more informational support in your life, or if you need more emotional support in your life, or if you're needing support in all the different areas that we discussed. Here's a difficult case to consider. Oftentimes I have patients tell me, you know, sometimes people offer me support when I don't even want it. So when support is unwanted or unneeded, what should you do? Here's a common example for people with MS. Oftentimes people with MS have well-meaning friends or well-meaning families offering them healthcare advice or strongly encouraging you to try a new treatment, whatever it might be. And this can be really difficult because the person offering the support is trying to be helpful, but honestly, they're irritating you. You already have a good handle on the MS. You have good information from your providers, from the MS Society. You've done a lot of readings and research on your own. So you've already decided on a management plan for your MS, and you feel good about that plan. So in such cases, when someone is well-meaning, but they're pushing you to do a treatment, a therapy, to try something out there, you know, what do you do? Rather than ask the person to stop and get upset with them, it's usually helpful to acknowledge their good intentions and then direct them towards something that you do need. For example, you might say to them, I know that you're offering this advice because you want to help, but I already have a lot of good information about my treatment options. I could use your help in some other ways, though. Do you think you could help me organize some of my medical bills and help me figure out what I need to do with them? So redirect people. Another difficult case or situation that can come up is trying to deal with people who don't provide any support. And we probably have all run into people like this in our lives before. Accepting when another person cannot or will not provide support is very important. Although it's hard not to personalize it when you don't get the support you need, it's important to realize that it's not necessarily a reflection of you. You may want to come up with ways to limit your interactions with people who are critical or rejecting in all areas of support. And that's one of the common myths. A myth out there is that social support is a positive thing. But if your support is unhealthy or abusive, it can be more damaging than not having any support at all. Okay, so we kind of talked about the different types of support, encouraging you to think about who you have in your life that provides those different types of support and what areas you need to kind of bolster in terms of your support systems. Now let's talk about how to ask for help. Asking for support or for help isn't easy. You know, lots of people take pride in being independent, and asking for support might feel like you're giving in or you're surrendering your independence or you're losing your dignity. And asking for support can also make you feel vulnerable because of the risk of being turned down or disappointed. So the way you think about asking for support can affect how you feel and can affect how you are able to accept the support. So there's a little formula that I like to use to kind of remind people about the four steps that are important in asking and requesting for help. It's called the D-E-S-C formula, D as in dog, E as in elephant, S as in snake, and C as in cat. Let's talk about what each of these little letters mean, and then we'll go through a couple examples. The D stands for describe the situation. That's first and foremost. E stands for express how you feel. S stands for specific changes or requests that you would like to see happen. And C is consequences of your request. Review in advance. Most people are really good at describing the situation and expressing how they feel, but they don't complete the communication, and they don't get to the point about specific changes or requests, and they don't review the consequences in advance. So let's talk about a situation, and then we'll go through each of the steps so you can see how you can ask for help in a way that hopefully improves the likelihood that you'll get your request needs met and you'll feel good about it. So here's the situation. You're becoming frustrated and angry because your phone calls are not being returned in a timely manner by your friend. Okay? So that's the situation. Here's the describe part. Let's say you're talking to your friend and you say to this friend, "Your friendship is really important to me. I value the time we get to talk together on the phone, but I need you to know that when I leave a message and then I don't hear back from you, it's upsetting to me." So you're describing the situation. The next part, express. Express your feelings. "I feel hurt and disappointed. Even though you have never said this to me, I feel like I don't matter to you." And oftentimes, again, people stop there and they just leave it to the person then to kind of have to jump in and say something. But I want to encourage you to finish the conversation, finish the request, which is specific changes. What would you like to request? So here's the specific changes. "I know you are busy. You work full-time, you have 3 kids, and you're busy volunteering at your kid's school. But it would really help me if you could call me back within 3 days, even if it's just to say you're too busy to talk right at the moment. Then perhaps we could come up with a time that would be better for both of us." So there you're giving your friend a real specific request, so she knows what the expectation is. And then again, before you even have this conversation and you go through all these, you need to reevaluate the consequences of your request. So this would be how you would do that. You might say to yourself, "I will feel better knowing that I let my friend know how I was feeling and what I would like her to do instead of just ignoring my phone calls. If she agrees to my request, I will feel a lot better. If not, I know not to invest my time and energy in calling her and having unrealistic expectations." So there's an entire situation where we won't go through the 4 steps. And if you do this in advance and then you communicate in this way, not only are you more likely to get your needs met, but if you don't get your needs met, you're already prepared and have an advanced review what the options are. I'd like to do one more example, and then we'll move on to another topic or area related to social support. Here's the situation. You would like your friend to come over to your house and help you organize one of your closets because you cannot physically lift the boxes and you could use some help deciding what's important to keep and what to throw out. So, describe the situation. "I really appreciate the fact that you are so organized and you seem to know what's important to keep and what to throw out. I know you are busy and have a lot going on, but I would really appreciate it if you could help me organize a closet in my office." Express your feelings. "I feel overwhelmed just thinking about the mess in the closet, and honestly, I don't know how to begin." Specific request. "I was hoping you might be able to come over for 3 hours one morning and help me unpack all the boxes in there now and then give me some direction on what to keep and what to throw out. I could then work on that part on my own. Then perhaps you could come back over for another hour and help me organize things back into the closet. Do you think you could help me with this project?" And again, before you engage in this request, you want to review the consequences. The worst thing that could happen is she would say no. "I would be no worse off than if I hadn't asked. And it's important for me to remember that even if she says no, it doesn't mean that we're not friends. The best thing that could happen is if she agrees to help me, I will finally be able to get my closet organized. If I ask, there is a chance. If I don't ask, there is no chance." So that's a way to use the DESC formula to make sure that you're sending a complete communication about a request, about something that you would like help with or support for. And if you do that, you're going to be more likely, again, to have success in getting your needs met and also to feel better regardless of what the outcome of the interaction is. Okay, so what I want to focus on now is kind of shift gears just a little bit and talk about barriers or things that get in the way of people putting themselves out there and meeting new people and making new social contacts. And I first want to address psychological barriers, and then we'll talk a little bit about physical barriers, and we'll talk about psychiatric barriers. But in terms of psychological barriers, one thing that I've seen in practice and in talking to a lot of patients is that some people just are shy. And sometimes shyness is a result of low self-esteem. So trying to have or develop healthy relationships when you are shy or you have low self-esteem is like a human being trying to breathe underwater like a fish. Sometimes you just don't have the skills for it. When you have a poor opinion of yourself and you feel unworthy, you doubt other people's intentions and motivations to be around you, and you can easily become suspicious or jealous. And when you feel inferior, you may try too hard to please others. You may also expect recognition for your work or efforts, which may not be forthcoming. And you may need to love and respect yourself, really, before you can fully embrace healthy relationships. So that's one psychological barrier, shyness, which is often rooted in low self-esteem. So low self-esteem often leads us to not set any goals for ourselves, to procrastinate doing things because we are fearful, and to really quit rather than persevering when we're faced with challenges. So if that's something that gets in the way of you getting out there and building your social support network, then you know that's something you need to face and to address and to get some help for. Another psychological barrier is what I call aversion to risk or moving out of your comfort zone. Really, the only way to improve yourself and your opportunity to meet people is by stepping out of your comfort zone and taking the risk to make mistakes. An analogy to this is that I don't think I've ever met a toddler who learned to walk without falling. So trying new things that you usually avoid because you think you're not good at it is part of what you need to do. You need to be willing to take risks. So get in the habit of expanding your comfort zone, and you might be surprised by what you can do. And remember that it's okay to fail. It's part of the learning process. I sort of believe that a step in the wrong direction is better than standing still your whole life. So kind of, again, think about expanding your comfort zone, addressing any shyness or low self-esteem. A third psychological barrier is to really address the fears that underlie your aversion to taking any risks. And probably the biggest fear I hear people talk about is their fear of rejection. You know, the fear of rejection may be the root problem in all of these situations. It's often what may prevent you from attempting to make new friends, reaching out to others, or even telling other people about your MS. If you value other people and how they feel about you, it's sort of natural that you would have some fear of rejection. And what does fear of rejection mean? Well, fear of rejection means maybe the fear of being alone. You know, underlying that rejection may be the fear that you'll end up all alone in the world and that no one will really care about you. And dealing with loneliness becomes a problem when it's constant and when you don't feel like it's a choice. But there was a quote that I read from some unknown author, and it said, "You cannot be lonely if you like the person you are alone with." And I think it kind of, again, all stems and comes full circle to fear of loneliness, fear of rejection, fear of moving out of your comfort zone, fear of taking chances. All can come down to, again, low self-esteem and this sense of fear of being alone. A couple of things about the fear of being alone that we need to talk about, and that is the fear of being alone means that somehow you don't believe you can create your own happiness. The thought of being all alone in the world is not in and of itself anything to panic about, but some people do. They panic at the thought that they might be alone for the rest of their lives. If you believe that you can take care of your own emotional needs and be happy even if you are alone, then being alone is nothing to fear. If you believe that you need others to take care of you and make you happy, then this is what can lead to the fear of being alone. So learning how to create your own happiness alone is a key part of building self-confidence and overcoming fears of rejection and loneliness. As long as you do not believe that you can create your own happiness and enjoy life alone, then you'll be less confident and more dependent on others to create your happiness. And sometimes what happens, and you don't even realize this is happening, is that you become emotionally needy. And when you're emotionally needy, you unfortunately end up pushing sometimes potential friends away. Because as your desperation rises, your chances of meeting new people and making new friends actually diminishes. So learning to do things on your own and getting out in the community is really important, but a lot of people hate to do things alone, so they don't. A A common reason is that they're afraid about what others will think about them coming to alone to an event or going out to dinner alone. But you know what? If you continue to do activities alone, eventually it won't bother you at all. It certainly won't bother other people because they are focused on their own enjoyment of the activity. So I'm not suggesting that you will spend all your time doing things alone, but that's one way to start building self-confidence in yourself and realizing that you are fully capable of engaging in activities, and it may not necessarily need to fall on somebody else's shoulders to be a part of that experience. The other thing about fear of rejection means that there may be some negative feedback about who you are, and you may fear that. For people living with MS, sometimes your self-image is really closely tied to how you define yourself. Are you, you know, I am athletic, I'm a go-getter, I'm an overachiever, I'm always well-liked. And anytime there's threats to these self-concepts, it can create a great deal of anxiety. Or perhaps you've had a life script that says, you know what, I'm going to be married and have a good job and I'm going to have kids, I'm going to have a number of close friends. But again, the MS can shatter any number of those sort of life scripts. And so to the degree that these expectations are threatened and you cannot see how you can be happy without them, that can lead again to social isolation and anxiety. Sometimes you have to be willing to change how you define yourself and your expectations for your future before you can get into a healthy relationship or meet other people. Another psychological barrier is what I call the excuses barrier. So take a moment and think about what excuses do you often have for not initiating a phone call to someone, for not going to that social support meeting that you promised yourself you would go to. What are those excuses? Well, there are many. You can fill in the blank. Just have the statement, I am too blank, and you can fill it in with any number of things, and that becomes an excuse that gets in your way. I am afraid. I am shy. I am boring. I am quiet. I am too tired. I am nervous. I am awkward. I am disabled. The list can be endless. So you may want to take a moment and make a list of the excuses that you commonly hear coming out of your mouth. Then take each one of those excuses and decide if you can change it or accept it as it is. Those are your two options, change or accept, and then move on. The other thing that I think sometimes becomes a psychological barrier to obtaining social support is that we limit our own choices because we have a stereotyped image of our potential friends. So some people limit their choices and options of friendships because they have preconceived ideas or stereotypes of certain people. So for example, I don't want to be friends with someone who doesn't drive a nice car, or who is heavy, or who lives in an apartment, or who has a pet, or who is a certain ethnicity. And so we narrow the choices before we even begin the process. So take a moment and make a list of any stereotypes which prevent you from approaching certain people or considering certain people as potential friends. Make an effort to overcome these stereotypes. So one way to do that is get to know people who fit your stereotypes and see what happens. Is it as bad as you thought? And ironically, some people who have chronic illness or disability are not interested in developing friendships with others who may have a chronic illness or disability. And I always find that kind of interesting, but unfortunately very true. So think about, am I limiting my choices? Another thing that I like to think of as a psychological barrier to overcome is to focus on your actions and not people's reactions. So when you meet people, approach people, talk to people, try to help people, focus on what you are doing and not so much on their reactions to you. If you focus on their reactions, something that you cannot control, you might find yourself being disappointed, angry, or depressed. So focus on what you can control. In the long run, you may not want to invest much energy in a friendship if you don't receive enough of what you want in return. However, in the short term, focus on your actions and be the kind of person in a friendship that you want to be. And the other thing that I like to think about as a psychological barrier is that sometimes people who have more time on their hands, and sometimes this is patients with MS who are not working, they sort of feel like they're always the one that have to send out the invitation, initiate the contact, and the burden falls on them to do so because their other friends are always so busy, or they don't think to call you, or they don't think that you can do something because you must be too tired. So you're always the one doing the invitation. And I want to encourage you not to see that as a burden or to see that as an inconvenience, but to see it kind of as an opportunity. You know, and some people don't like to ask people to do things with them because they feel anxious, because they worry someone might say no. So try viewing an invitation as a gift. It's a gift in two ways. You're complimenting the other person because you're basically telling them, I care about you and I find you enjoyable to spend time with. And two, your time is a gift which you're offering to them. So even if they reject the offer to spend time together, they still receive the gift of the compliment. So kind of view it that way. And again, if you have a lot of time on your hands, then don't be surprised if you find yourself having to take more of the initiative in making invitations to others. And don't view this as a burden, but view it as an opportunity. So those were a lot of psychological barriers that can get in the way of people extending themselves and making an effort to meet new people. Just some physical barriers to consider are transportation challenges, mobility challenges, and of course, fatigue and endurance. And I believe Greg will speak to a little bit of some of the transportation and mobility challenges. But if you're finding that fatigue and endurance is a problem, make sure you talk to your healthcare provider about that and see if you're doing everything you can to conserve energy and to maximize your energy output for the day. The last thing about barriers is make sure you're treating any psychiatric barriers to meeting new people and to expanding your support network. Psychiatric barriers can include depression, social anxiety, substance abuse, anger management problems, eating disorders, and the list goes on. Depression will tell you, don't get up in the morning, don't answer the phone, don't respond to emails, don't do anything. Social anxiety will say, you're not good enough, they may say no. I don't want to deal with that. I'm too nervous to even consider going out. It scares me. You know, so those are all barriers, again, that can be treated with some help and hopefully, again, eliminate some of the barriers. Just a few questions to ask yourself and think about as a wrap-up here. Who do I have in my life to support me? What kind of things do people do that I find supportive? In what ways am I supportive of other people? And do I want more support in my life, or am I happy with the support that I have? Expanding your opportunities. No one's just going to show up at your doorstep. You must act. Doing nothing is really not an option. And Greg will be talking about some of the ways to meet people to expand your community of support in our next session. So, Elna, I'm ready for a few questions from the audience, and I think we have about 5 minutes for that. And then after we're done with the five-minute question and answer, Greg will then start talking about, again, ways to build your community of support.
Yes, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if there's any questions that you have, please press the number one key on your phone. We have two parties in queue for question. Our first question is from Deb. Go ahead, Deb.
Hi. Hi, Deb. I was just curious, you were talking about depression and stuff, and I have bipolar disorder, and mostly a little bit on the hypomanic side. I was just, one part of my brain is saying go, and the other part is saying no. And I'm just wondering if there's other if there's somewhere online I could go or somebody to get some information on bipolar and MS, or if there's a group somewhere in Washington, or is there some kind of any sort of information on, you know, just maybe just even gentle mental illness, so I could find out some more information on that.
Sure. Deb, you're talking about bipolar disorder, which is a condition in which people can vacillate between being depressed at one point and then becoming almost quite energetic and almost what we call manic in other times in their life. And Deb, I would recommend that you might want to access the National Association for Mental Illness, NAMI. They are a great resource and have lots of information about bipolar disorder and how that affects people. It may not be specific to MS, but they would have lots of information. And NAMI also has listings for support groups and things in local areas. So that may be an online source that you might want to access to get some information about that.
Yeah, and it's great for some other people that, you know, have the same problem.
Mm-hmm. And again, it might be good for you to be able to go to a local support group sponsored by NAMI that you might find very helpful. And the other thing is, if you find that your hypomanic tendencies really interfere with you being able to develop better relationships with people, you know, you may want to get a little bit of individual help to figure out, how do I manage this better? You know, what can I do to contain some of that hypomania so that it doesn't interfere?
Okay, that sounds great. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Deb.
Our next question is from Mike. Mike, go ahead.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. The main thing I noticed, my wife has MS, the main mm-hmm. thing I noticed with people, I guess, with disabilities, is they don't want to feel pitied. That's one of the reasons they don't look to broaden their social network or to ask people for help, because they know that once people find out that they have a real issue, it's very nice when they limp a little bit, but once, like, my wife starts using a walker now, we know people are pitying us, even though it's not our problem. But you know, once you know people are pitying you, you don't want to call them, oh, can you help me with this, can you help me with that, can you do that? That was, how do you deal with that? That's question number one. And question number two is, a family member is very nice and very helpful, but they don't want to give any, they can't accept that she has this problem. And they won't give any emotional support, like, oh, what do you mean you can't do this? And it got a little better over the years, but it's pretty pathetic. How do you deal with that? We can't cut off our ties with them. It doesn't work like that for this particular person.
Okay.
We live in the same city. We live next to them. And so that's my two questions. But thank
okay.
you for the great speech.
You're welcome. Mike, those are really great questions, and I'm sure they apply to a lot of people. So let me take the first part of the question. That was, how do you deal with asking for help or asking for support when you don't want to be pitied by others? That's a common thing that patients will talk about, but I think sometimes what happens is it's more related to how the patient is feeling rather than how the other person is actually thinking. Because when I talk to friends, family members of people affected with MS, or even strangers on the street, and we do informational or educational meetings about disability and what do you do when you encounter someone who may present with a disability, most people don't say, oh, I pity them. That's not the reaction that we get from other people in their lives. What we get is, hey, if I can be helpful, I want to be helpful. That's not pity. That's a genuine willingness and wanting to be of help of some sort. And what I tell patients is, you know, sometimes giving people in your life or even acquaintances or strangers something to do makes them feel like they're a part of your life and they could be helpful. It's really frustrating for them to be on the periphery and never get asked for help, because it's not that they pity you. They just want to be helpful and be able to be a resource for you. And so sometimes it's from the MS patient themselves that they have to get over that idea that they don't want to be pitied. Most people don't want to pity you. Most people, there's no time for that, and that doesn't even cross their mind. So you have to get comfortable with asking for help and realizing somebody doesn't want to give you help, they're not going to come through. Trust me, they don't do it because they feel like they have to. Most people help because they want to. And most people feel like they're that all they can do is worry and they can't fix anything and they can't make it better for you. So they often like having a job or something to do, because that's their way of being able to offer some support and help. So they feel better as well. So asking for help goes two ways. They feel better that they can be involved, and you can appreciate the help that you're receiving. So remember that pitying often is more a feeling coming from the patient than it really is coming from the other folks. Your second question was, how do you deal with family members when they can't accept the MS and they won't give the emotional support? and you can't cut them off. Good question. What I encourage patients to think about is you can't change them, but what you can do is manage your own expectations. So kind of like we talked about, if you know that these family members can't offer you any emotional support, can they offer you tangible support? Can they offer you just companionship support? If so, kind of take their lead and figure out what do they feel comfortable doing with you or for you. If it's nothing and they can't offer any support of any kind in any of those areas, then what you have to do is you just have to manage your expectations. And what you have to tell yourself is, okay, they don't accept it, they don't understand it, I don't know if they ever will. So I'm going to get my support elsewhere, and I'm just going to let them, you know, and I'm not going to expect anything from them in that regard because they're unable to give that. That's a hard thing when it falls on you as the patient and the family and the spouse to have to manage your own expectations when you know that the other party is not at a place where they can provide the support that you need. So you don't throw them out, but you have to manage your expectations and realize they're incapable at this moment to either understand, accept, or provide you with the support that you need. I hope that helps, Mike. And I think we're ready now, Alma, to move on to Greg's presentation.
Yes, ma'am. There are no more questions in queue.
Okay, great. Thank you, Michelle, and good evening, everybody. I'm Greg Robinson. I am the Connections Programs Manager for the Greater Northwest Chapter of the National MS Society, and I really appreciated listening to Dr. Toshima's remarks and thinking about some of the Connections Programs that we have at our chapter and how they fit in with some of the principles and ideas that she was talking about. The first thing I want to talk about is our self-help group program. This is a program that's offered by every chapter of the Greater Northwest of the National MS Society. And in our Greater Northwest chapter, we have over 40 self-help groups in a variety of locations and in a variety of styles and approaches. The basic idea of a support group is people coming together and meeting other people that are like them. Just to get that emotional support from somebody else who's been through some of the same kinds of situations and maybe the same types of experiences, in this case, living with MS. We did a survey last year of our self-help group members and the leaders of those groups, and the number one reason by far why people said they attended groups was to meet other people with MS. They said things like meeting people who have MS, who understand, who have similar experiences, or who are like me. People said that support, sharing, friendship, socializing, and feeling less alone were very, very important. Now, there's a lot of knowledge to be gained from attending a self-help group about MS and the latest research and treatments and what other people are doing to cope with their MS. But by far and away, the biggest single reason, again, why people tended to attend self-help groups was because of the support that they get just from being with other people who are like them. We have, as I mentioned, over 40 groups. Most of these do meet in a face-to-face way, usually once a month, but sometimes a little different than that. And so it really is a chance to practice some of those steps that Dr. Toshima talked about of getting out and meeting with others. One of the nice things about the program is that if you are interested in attending a support group and you call our Information Resource Center, which is 1-800-344-4867, you'll be hearing that number, I think, a few more times tonight because we really want to encourage everybody to contact us at the Information Resource Center if you have any questions about our programs, services, or other information that we can provide to you. If you're looking for a support group in your area and you contact the Information Resource Center, the specialist there, if there is a group in your area, will give you the leader's name and phone number. And you have the opportunity to call and ask, tell me a little bit about the group. You know, what are they like? How many are they younger? Are they older? What do you do at the meeting? What do you talk about? And you can get sort of a sense of, is this something that's going to work for me? And I can tell you from my experience that in most cases, people really do want to go at least the first time and attend the group and see if it works for them. And in many, many cases, it does. And people continue to go and build a really strong connection and a real community of support that way. For people who cannot easily get out of their house or where they're living, you know, for whom transportation or there's other barriers to getting out, or if you're in an area where there is not currently a self-help group available, we do have a telephone support group. It's a chapter-wide it's called the Stay at Home Telephone Support Group, and they talk on the third Wednesday of every month at 1 p.m. Pacific time. And again, for details on that group, for instance, the number to call in and so forth, contact 1-800-344-4867, and they can provide that for you. We also have caregiver support groups. We have two of them right now in our chapter area, and we'd like to have more. So I'll talk in a minute here about the idea of starting a group, but the Information and Resource Center can provide you with other types of caregiver support groups that may be in your area. For instance, many hospitals or senior centers have groups, support groups, specifically designed for family members or caregivers, the people living with a disability or for the elderly, and it may not fit exactly what your situation is as a caregiver, but again, just that idea of being with others who are in a similar place is a very, very powerful experience. So what if you are interested in a support group and there isn't one? Well, that's what I'm here for at our chapter and people in my role at other chapters. We are called the Liaisons for the Connections Programs, and part of our job is to help you get a group started. It's really a matter of finding two or three other people who are interested in getting together, and usually that's exactly how it works. We can help you find the location, offer you promotion, training as a leader, help you pay for refreshments and other program and group expenses, and we offer ongoing consultation and support. So again, contact our Information and Resource Center, and we can start talking about that. So that's essentially, in a nutshell, our support group program. I'm going to move real quickly through to the next couple of things because I know we have a few more things to talk about tonight. But a second way to connect with others is through peer support. If you're not really quite ready yet to go out and meet other people in a group, but you do need some information, emotional support or informational support, like Dr. Toshiba mentioned, a great way to get that is through our peer support program. There's a couple of different, actually a couple of different peer support programs. All of them offer this sort of emotional and informational support in different ways. The first one is MS Friends, which is a national program. It is sponsored by the National MS Society. If you call and say, I'd like to speak with somebody, I have questions about MS or about a specific treatment, they will match you up, usually within one day, with somebody else, a volunteer, who can talk with you right away about your questions. To reach MS Friends, the number is 1-866-673-7436. If you miss that or don't have anything to write with, all you really need to remember is 1-800-344-4867, 1-800-FIGHT-MS, and we can get you these phone numbers at any time. But MS Friends is a great resource. The second is what's called the Someone to Listen program. It's also being matched up with a trained volunteer who has MS, is living with MS. And this offers you the chance to sort of form an ongoing relationship, usually for 3 to 6 months, and some ongoing support in learning new coping skills, learning new strategies for dealing with your MS, finding different ways to do that. So again, the way to access that program is to contact our Information and Resource Center. There is also a new online peer support program being planned by the National MS Society. It's not quite available yet, but if you watch our website or contact the Information Resource Center, they can give you a little sense of when that's going to be active. But again, you can get matched with a person who has some similar experiences as you, similar in age or gender, type of MS that you're living with, and that whole program will allow people to connect via email, and that, of course, is becoming more and more common way for people to communicate and a really good way to connect. So that is some different ways that the peer support program can be available to you for support. And the last thing that I'll mention, two more things, but MS World is an online, it's a site, it's a website, www.msworld.org. They provide monitored chat rooms. It's a good way to get information about MS medications and treatments from people who have been on them. And it's a good way to find out about online support groups. Deb, your question earlier about other people with the bipolar disorder and living with MS, I was thinking about MS World as one way that you may be able to get some answers or meet some other people from around the country who are in that situation. So the last thing I'm going to mention here is volunteering, because every chapter, including ours, really has a need for your participation as a volunteer. And in addition, of course, to helping in the mission of a world free of MS, our volunteers help with everything from mailings to data entry to outreach committees and day of special event help. And these volunteer opportunities provide a great way to meet other people who are passionate about the mission of the National MS Society and people who are living with MS. So strongly encourage you to contact our chapter about volunteer opportunities. Okay? So with that, before we're going to have another chance to ask questions, but I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Piper Reynolds for a couple of more ways that you can build your support network. Piper.
All right. Thanks so much, Greg. That was great. So I have a couple more things to share with you all about ways to connect with others. In the online world, speaking of MS World chat groups, there's also, of course, Facebook. And you can connect with the chapter and people around you through Facebook by becoming a fan of our page. It's the Greater Northwest Chapter page. You can participate in discussion with others living with MS and stay updated on chapter happenings and society-wide research. We often post exclusive videos and photos of things that our members are doing across the chapter, as well as sneak peeks on our fundraising contests and other things. But most importantly, you can connect to others living with MS. It's a truly great way to stay connected and up to date on what's happening in the world of MS. So, again, that's on Facebook, National MS Society Greater Northwest Chapter. And also, our Walk MS event is a really wonderful place for everyone to be a part of the MS movement and to support each other and show your support and pride to people in your local community. Our Walk MS events come up usually in the spring, and there are 23 walks that take place across our three-state chapter, which is Alaska, Montana, and Washington. And Walk MS is a truly inspiring and family-friendly event that attracts a wide audience, so people newly diagnosed to those who have lived with MS for many years, as well as their friends, family, coworkers, and many more. Everyone is welcome to Walk MS, and fundraising is not required to be a part of it. The event has a very festive, upbeat feel with music and team tents. We take photos. There's free breakfast and lunch. And, of course, there's a walk route itself. But again, the walk route is optional, but it's a really empowering way to proudly show the community your support of the MS movement. Again, I'd like to emphasize that everyone's welcome to Walk MS. Fundraising is not a requirement to join and be a part of the event. Also, walking is not a requirement. If you don't want to go out on the walk route, you're certainly welcome to stay at the Walker Village. And our Walk MS events begin at 9 a.m. in the morning until 12:30 p.m. in the afternoon on a Saturday. Again, these events will happen in the spring of 2012, so it's coming right up. And depending on your walk site that you choose to go to, there would be a few hundred people to over 5,000 people at the Seattle Walk event. So really a very inspiring, awesome event to be a part of. The walk route itself is outdoors, but is fully accessible. We always hope for sunshine, but plan to walk rain or shine. And again, you aren't required to go on the walk route if you choose not to. Walk MS is really a great place to meet other people affected by MS. So we encourage anybody that comes to come ready to introduce yourself to others. And again, piggybacking on what Greg said, volunteering at our Walk MS events is one of the best ways to meet other people. Our volunteers tend to really bond with each other after going through this giant event experience. It's really wonderful. And there's lots of ways to volunteer with Walk MS, from helping set things up at the beginning or handing out food during lunch or cheering at the finish line. Lots of different ways that you could help out. And this year, for first-time participants living with MS, if you're new to the walk, you're interested in joining, but you're not exactly sure how to register or when it takes place, you're certainly invited to join a special team we're organizing by the chapter. It's the National MS Society team. It's called Team MS Equals. And there's going to be much more information coming up in the mail and also on our website, so keep your eye open for that. We also offer education programs all throughout our chapter region. And our education programs teach skills and strategies for managing MS while also providing avenues for friendship, information, and encouragement. Our education programs are offered throughout the chapter. We meet either in a group setting. We also have education programs online or over the phone, like this one tonight. Our education programs are tailored to meet the unique needs and interests of people with MS and provide information on a variety of MS topics, from symptom management and treatments to up-to-date research and tools for living well with MS. You can learn from the comfort of your own home through a teleconference like tonight, or we have lots of online classes that you can take as well. Or you can get out and meet others in your community at an in-person workshop that comes to your community. Whatever your preference, we have convenient options in a variety of formats to meet you where you are. All of our chapter education programs are free, and they vary in topic and location. And we choose the topics and location based on feedback provided to us by people with MS. So these programs really do provide the unmatched opportunity to gain knowledge and skills about how to live your most optimal life with MS from top MS professionals in our chapter community, like Dr. Toshima with us tonight. One of the greatest benefits of our education programs is the opportunity to connect to others like you, share stories and strategies on how you live well with MS, and build relationships with people who understand. Our programs are continually updated on our online calendar on our website. Our website is www.msnorthwest.org. And you'll also find our online calendar. There are other community events listed that aren't chapter-sponsored events, but great MS education events to be a part of throughout the chapter. Also, you can find out about education programs through our quarterly MS Connections magazine, and we'll periodically mail out event flyers to you as well. And we also try to send notifications through email and through the phone. So try many different ways to get the word out about our programs. Again, you can find out about education programs through our online calendar, or as Greg had mentioned, you can always call the Information Resource Center. That number is 1-800-344-4867. And that calling that number, you can stay up to date on what's happening near you. A couple other things before we wrap up for our last question and answer is our advocacy program. For those living in Washington State, we have another opportunity coming up. Called our Day of Activism in Olympia, Washington, and that's going to be on January 30th. During this event, we bring the stories of people living with MS to our state elected officials, reminding them of the responsibility everyone has to meet the needs of our citizens, especially those with MS and other chronic diseases. So just like Walk MS, this Day of Activism is open to everyone living with multiple sclerosis and is a really great way to advocate for yourself and others, and learn how the legislative process works, meet others who care about these important issues. It's a really fun day down at the state capitol. That's coming up on January 30th. And if we have anybody listening from the Oregon and Inland Northwest chapters on tonight's teleconference, most of the programs and services described in this teleconference are also offered in your chapters. So again, finding information about any National MS Society programs, please call 1-800-344-4867. And we're at the 7:30 mark, but we'll just go over by a couple minutes if we have any questions. Alma, we'll go ahead and take those now.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Ms. Piper, there are no questions in queue.
Okay. Well, I'm assuming that's because we've answered them all. All right. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for being on the call. And special thanks to Dr. Toshima for your wonderful presentation this evening. Thanks again for everybody for joining us. Thank you, Greg, for being a part of the call this evening. And I will be sending out an email and also a letter to those that don't have email tomorrow that contains all the information that you heard in today's teleconference, all in one place. So with that, we'll end the call, and I hope everyone has a really great night. Bye-bye.